Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Oh, my word, it started so live. Like with John Gibbons, Paul Cobain, Kev Walsh. That's like, these openings aren't smooth, are they, John?
The dramatic, if anything, do you know what I mean? I'm worried I've been left in the stalls, so to speak, and everyone else
is how you always are.
Yeah, it's like it's like someone plunges you. Like it's like Kev Walsh pushes you into a swimming pool when you're not prepared for it. It's exactly what it's like.
He doesn't know. As I was doing yesterday to everyone in the Albert.
Yeah, Kev doesn't know what you're on about. What, push people in the pool? What do you mean?
Yeah, never. He is an angel. He is an angel. It is Neil Atkinson, as I said before. It is John Gibbons, Paul Copan, Kev Walsh. This is the Anfield Wrap Live, looking ahead to a massive weekend against Leeds United. We're going to get stuck into exactly how big that weekend is and what it could mean for Liverpool's season, not least because of the other games that are going on. Have you looked at the other games?
I haven't, yeah.
It's
I should engage with it.
Oh, Leicester are playing Man City.
I saw that one, yeah.
Yeah, Leicester are playing Man City.
United are home to Newcastle.
They are indeed. Chelsea have got Villa, which will be an interesting one, if nothing else. But almost like Arsenal are playing Norwich, which just feels... Do you know, like when in a film, in an old sort of style movie, someone leaves a banana skin or is carrying a piece of wood and turning around with it and all that sort of stuff. It's that sort of build up to a football match, like nothing you've seen in your life. So it's a really interesting weekend to come. But obviously the big one for us is Liverpool Football Club. It's also the FIFA question, Kev. This is the strangeness of everything, really, is what we're talking about here. The idea that we... Right now, Jurgen Klopp, he's probably working as we're doing this. He's probably, 4 o'clock seems about right. He likes to get them training at the time that they're going to play. And he doesn't know if he's going to be able to pick Alisson Becker or Fabinho. How does he work on shape? What's his outlook, Kev? I think it's a nightmare, and it feels as though it's entirely man-made.
It's entirely man-made, and it's entirely made of the fact that football, everybody assumes themselves to be the most important person in the room. So FIFA... Obviously, they run world football, so you'd say, well, probably it is them. But then, if the Premier League say to FIFA, okay, well, we don't want to be part of any of your stuff, go away, they'll be like, shit, we lose a big player there, don't we? So, it's everyone just trying to throw the weight around. And the best thing about it is, how can you have a rule whereby one of the players, because we like their team, is allowed to play, and the rest of them aren't? It's absolute madness. To be fair, I'd love the needle if it were around them. They let our three players play and Richarlison couldn't. That'd be fantastic. I'd be all for that.
I've got no shadow of a doubt you'd be all for that. Paul, I think Kev's analysis there, that everybody thinks their thing is the most important thing, it's a decent one, to be honest with you. But it's also it's the positioning and the politicking. And it's just the refusal to acknowledge reality. If those Liverpool players had gone out to Brazil, they wouldn't be able to play against Leeds anyway. They wouldn't be able to play against AC Milan. They wouldn't be able to play against Crystal Palace. And I think they'd be touch and go for Norwich. I don't know. It would depend literally what day they got back in the country as to whether or not they could play in the Norwich game in the League Cup if we wanted that. That is no way to be. But not only that, they'd basically go to seed. They'd be in a hotel room. They wouldn't be able to quarantine in decent circumstances. They wouldn't be able to train as footballers. It feels... almost on the verge of just being, and I use this phrase really, really lightly, you know, I don't want people to think I'm overstating it, but there's almost very mild form of abuse in this towards these athletes. It's not good for them to have to have gone through that reality.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking far too much sense in all of that though, Neil, aren't you? Like, I think just generally speaking, I'm away, so I've had a little bit of time to like sit back and reflect recently, and a conclusion I've come to, just generally speaking in life, is humans are just mental. Like, just across the board, humans are just mental, and we like to break it down and get into all this nitty gritty and all that. But I think the humans involved in football are maybe the most mental, because like through all of this, like think about what's been going on in the world in the past 18 months and how the world has dealt with it, like outside of football, and then think about everything around footy. It's just like, it doesn't really matter. You're like, what? Like, we're going to still have international football tournaments. Like, is that a good idea, full stop? Like, even before we get into the nitty-gritty of UEFA and FIFA and all of that sort of stuff, is it a good idea to be moving people around all the... And it's not like this is the first time it's happened, is it? Like, this has been going on. We had the stuff in the Euros with VIPs and all that.
Yeah.
I just think that... I mean, we can go into all kinds. I've got a lovely thing about Wenger at the moment. Like, Joe, like you've got all this madness with FIFA and UEFA, and then I think you get like the likes of Klopp banging his head against the brick wall, talking about the welfare of players and too many games and all that stuff, and then this stuff on top in the middle of a pandemic, and then someone like Wenger gets involved, and I bet you like Klopp and Guardiola are thinking, oh, do you know what? At last, someone sensible. And one of the first things he does is go, I've got a good idea. World Cup's every 2 years. And I'm like,
yeah.
What? Our side, mate. So I don't know whether there's just something in the water at places like FIFA that just sends them even more mental. But it makes no sense what they're all doing. I'm with Kev on the Richarlison thing. I just wish it was the other way around.
I mean, obviously, if it was the other way around, it'd have punchlines, John, but it still wouldn't be particularly, you know, it still wouldn't be right. I think the whole thing isn't right. I think I think that the footballers' welfare does have to just come first in these scenarios, and I would like to think that would be the thing that would be at the forefront of the Brazilian FA's mind. I mean, they need these footballers in the best possible shape. They don't need to be running around irritating people. What worries me is ever footballers are going to end up stuck in the middle, which does not feel like it happens a lot.
Yeah, it does. And if only we had some sort of professional football association who were able to sort of stand up for footballers, some sort of voice for them, you know, regardless of where you come from, you know, if you're working in as a footballer in this country, you know, just like a union, you could call it, mate, a union, if you like.
An association, possibly.
Yeah, headed up by someone incredibly well paid, a Gordon or something, I don't know. You know, you pick your own person, because it obviously doesn't exist, because they have been silent throughout the whole thing. Say what you want about Wenger, but at least he's saying stuff. he's got too much time to think as well. He's not used it as well as copious.
But hang on, mate. Like, are we using that? Maybe Gordon's going with the, like, you're best just not saying anything. Like, anything I add to this is going to make it worse. So.
Yeah, have I got a solution? No, all right, I'll shut up. But I don't know. I feel like someone should be sticking up with the footballers, and if it's not the Professional Footballers Association, then I don't know. Maybe it's us. It feels, but you do feel for them, because they're sort of pulled around. And listen, a lot of Liverpool fans, you know, often come out with, oh, they should all just retire from an international football. And say, well, they don't want to. Do you know what I mean? Like, footballers, you know, you grow up, you know, wanting to play in World Cups, and people are patriotic, and it's just a laugh. You know, I'm sure playing for Brazil is a good laugh, and they enjoy it, and they get a sort of a laugh from it, really. There should just needs to be just a bit of sense for the small amounts of time, but there's so much money involved, and there's so much kind of pressure, you know, to get these games on. I've still got a cob on that they now play 3 times in 2 weeks. Like, how's that been snuck in?
Yeah, that feels like we all missed a meeting on that, doesn't it? Yeah, we didn't circulate a memo to the Anfield Rat. So
three games now. It's three. I've just bubbled out. I'm okay. It's 3 games now, and it just sort of feels kind of ridiculous, really. I don't. So it's no one's thinking of the players, and it's frustrating.
It is indeed, Paul. I'll just come back to you on this last little bit you mentioned there with Wenger. I think the thinking of the players thing is a massive aspect of this. We need it to be put at the forefront. And I don't know quite what the club does, because as a man with your background, if this thing could go on for a while, all the arguments can be heard. If there needs to be a legal aspect, that's absolutely fine. I was just talking before about Klopp's training. There's one aspect. It's not just the idea of where we are by 4:30 on Sunday. It's where we are by arguably midday, possibly even tomorrow, is the thing that I'd say. I imagine there's a lot of stuff going on in back rooms with people at the minute having a bit of murder, having an argument. And I reckon it's going to take a bit of sorting out. But the idea is, the key thing is, what do Liverpool do? Because there's a big ticking clock in the corner about when this game kicks off at Ellen Rose.
Yeah, it was funny enough. I was thinking about this before, and the type of lawyer I used to be, I would often talk to clients about the difference between technical rules and the real world. And I was seeing the other day that basically, if they don't comply with what FIFA is saying, the punishment is you automatically lose the game 3-0. Well, guess what? Both sides have got Brazilian players. So if I was Klopp and if I was the hierarchy at Liverpool, I'd be on the blower to Leeds and saying to them, lads, let's just play our players. In the real world, forget what they say. We can argue about this technically later. We haven't got time to do that now. Train this week. We'll play our players. You play your players. Let's do it in writing so we can't shaft each other on the day. We don't want to be like Alisson Becker's walking out and was like, where's Rafinha?
What's the quiz show at the end where you have to decide whether to keep or steal? It's like that one.
Golden balls.
Golden balls have just had him here from God himself. There we are.
That's what I'd be doing. I'd be saying, because what I'd work on is, well, what's your worst case scenario? Your worst case scenario is you play the game, you both play your players, you breach, and then ultimately, whatever the legal actions are that'll take time, you lose, and they say, well, even if you won the game, you lose your points. Well, okay, is that a risk worth taking? And just on the fly thinking about this, there's more than just the game on Saturday or Sunday at stake here. And I think from the footballers, when John's talking about, you know, someone's got to stand up for the footballers, well, maybe the football club should stand up for the footballers and say, well, we're just ignoring you. We're just ignoring FIFA.
On that, Kev, I think for me, this is the biggest aspect of this is that for me, this isn't just September. This isn't just going to be a one-off. I think sense will prevail here, but it'll end up being the sort of sense that's a bit of a shot across the bow. You best watch yourselves in October. You best watch yourselves in November. I think even if this gets resolved prior to the game against Leeds, prior to any of the weekend's games for any of the teams, I think it's going to keep coming back round. And I think that the footballers, the football clubs, the football supporters were stuck in the middle of a power struggle that's much bigger than us.
Well, that's exactly what's going to happen, because that's what happens every single time you have an issue like this, isn't it? They sort of fudge something that makes it go away for now. And then in this case, it'll be 3 or 4 weeks' time, we've got another international break and we have the same issues then. And as you say, it'll be like, well, we gave you this dispensation last time. And the clubs will be like, well, we're not having our players. Like, obviously, if you just think of it rationally, what you said before, you can't have top athletes just 3 times in 3 months going into a holiday inn. In the middle of the season. You just can't, like, rationally, nobody in the world thinks that's a good idea. But effectively, that's what Brazil are saying. That's the issue. And the other thing is, back to the Richarlison point, you can't have a rule where they say, okay, well, yes to you and no to you. It's either all or nothing. And I think the fact that that is in place and they've already said they'll let Richarlison play, the other teams will just say, well, it's a farce of a rule anyway. Back to the 3 points thing. Can FIFA take 3 points off the Premier League? How does that work? Surely the Premier League want to hold their own. Own sway, don't they, over their own league? So can FIFA say, well, we demand you dock 3 points?
So the weird thing is, so everyone's got basically FIFA, so, and this is why this is another huge philosophical issue, everyone's regulated by FIFA. So FIFA are the ultimate regulator, but in this instance, the dispute is about their own competition. And we've had this in the past, you know, it's something that drives me mad about the FA and the FA Cup and all this sort of stuff. The FA runs the competition, but it also gets to regulate football in this country, at least theoretically. We all know it does a dreadful job. But the theory, the plan is that that's how this works. And that's, for me, John, you know, this is a massive issue in football in general. UEFA own and regulate the Champions League. You know, FIFA own the World Cup. That's why they want to have another one, because there's more money in it. All the regulators, everyone's hands are dirty. Everyone's got skin in the game, which makes actual practical regulation impossible. And the Premier League have got to apply to FIFA in order to be signed off as the thing that runs the league in this country and all of that. So everything ends up back into this situation where it is this murky cesspit, to be honest with you.
I mean, yeah, it is. The more you think about it, the murky it is as well, and the more you talk about it. I mean, I'm happy to just call Everton busies if everyone else is and just wants to be involved.
Doll spies.
all that, yes, glasses get away with stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's how it works, doesn't it? The one kid in the class who's not punished and everyone else is, you know, that's Everton, and that's no place to be, I don't think. Do you know what I mean? But they've decided that's their future, and good luck to them. But you know, it's much more fun to skip to Everton a field than think about sort of FIFA UEFA. I mean, it is mad on UEFA, you talk about the idea of, you know, they own the competition, they own the rules and stuff like that. They even own your stadium for the 24 hours around
which
is one of my favourite things. We have to hand over Anfield to UEFA. And if they wanted to, they could just stick all the mates in. Maybe that's what they threaten. You know, when they say when everyone moans that they got too many tickets, they go, we could have all of them if we wanted to. You're happy to get any of your own fans in at all. It's just absolutely crazy. But yeah, it's one of those. And the more you think about it, the sort of the worse it gets when you're someone who just likes watching really good football players.
Absolutely. We are people who like watching really, really good football players, and we're lucky we get to watch them, and we'll be getting to watch them no matter what happens on Sunday. For those of you who are enjoying Tour Live through its live vehicles across many a platform right now, there will not be much of a gap. But for those of you who are listening to this as a podcast, which was recorded live, we'll be back immediately after the game again. Well, not immediately after, that would be too much. Very close to the end of the AC Milan game. We'll get your dates out around that next week. So if you want to come and enjoy and be part of the Tour Live experience, that will be absolutely phenomenal. If not, you are listening to this as a podcast, that's the business as well. And if you are listening to it as a podcast, my voice right now will hand over to my voice, which will tell you what the three wonderful inserts are that are coming with people as terrific as Dan Hewitt, Steve Martin and Dan Morgan, talking about a wide variety of subject matters. But if you're live, just count to three. We'll be right back at you.
And it's John Gibbons with an insert, courtesy of Football Prizes, and Football Prizes are partnering us for the moment on Weekender, and we really appreciate it. It's been good to get to know them, and it's good to see these great prizes that they keep putting online for you to win. And this week's is a belter. It's the main man himself, Jurgen Klopp, signed shirt that goes live this evening. There's only 99 tickets available, so you might have to be quick if you want that Jurgen Klopp signed shirt. It's framed, it's lovely, it's got a couple of nice pictures in there as well, and it's a really nice present for you or someone else if you can win it. 99 tickets, as I say, in the draw, only £4.95 if you want to enter. And yeah, you got a better 1 in 100 chance of winning. So if you want to enter, it's footballprizes.co.uk/product/shirt-Klopp. So that's footballprizes.co.uk/product/shirt-Klopp. I always have to wrap my words around my tongue there for a little bit for that one. We'll put a little link on our social media as well, on our Twitter tonight, and again next week, because it's Wednesday when the draw is. So Wednesday when this will be drawn, it's live on their Facebook, so you can see it's all legit and it's all right in front of you. And hopefully one of you lot wins. It'd be really nice if a subscriber wins, so let us know if you win this or if you've won any of the other football prizes competitions that we've been pushing. But yeah, I'll read out that address again, footballprizes.co.uk/product/shirt-Klopp, to win that lovely signed Jurgen Klopp shirt. Best of luck to you.
I hope you're enjoying Tour Live, the way in which we're doing it, a little bit different, but similar to the Weekender, because we've got the excellent inserts that tell a number of different stories. First and foremost, we've got Dan Morgan talking about World Suicide Prevention Day. Then, after that, we will have Steve Martin talking about the Anne Williams Golf Day, and then we'll have Dan Hewitt, who's a long-term contributor to the show, talking about a documentary he's got coming out on ITV around squalor and dreadful housing in the United Kingdom on Sunday at 10:15 p.m. So you're going to have Dan Morgan, Steve Martin, and then Dan Hewitt. Back in a minute. Pleasure to be joined by Steve Martin of the Anne Williams Golf Day to talk about what's become an institution, Steve. I mean, I'm not saying you're the hardest working man in Merseyside, but you're not far away from it these days.
We have our moments where we are very, very busy, especially when the event's so close now. There's four of us who put the event on, myself, Andy, Gaz and Sean. And without the four of us, the event just simply doesn't happen. We all play our part, and this will be the ninth event, but obviously last year was cancelled because of COVID.
Yeah, so it's the 10 years now at this point.
It'll be 10 years next year, but this is actually the ninth event officially, because on the shield we've actually put last year's event as COVID, because we don't want it to be a year gap. So obviously last year, just a quick one on last year's event, we were supposed to support fan support and food banks, and with the help of our ambassador, whole sponsors, player donations and other little bits and pieces, where we still managed to raise over £6,500 without an event.
That's absolutely incredible.
Which speaks volumes of what we're actually building up and the little community that we have become, and it is, we all look after ourselves. This year we've got 76 players in the field, we've got 20 caddies, and I think we've got about 140 people coming the evening to we say it's our special day for the special lady, but it's actually a yearly event now, people look forward to it. People are always on to us about how they can get involved, and it's that hard. It's hard to get listed on the season ticket waiting list.
Well, it's on this. Let's be clear about, you know, why you started doing it in the first place and what it was you were attempting to do. It was all about Anne, and it was about continuing on that battle that she was so integral to, that she started going right the way back, and that she was so integral to. Let's be absolutely clear about that. But now, obviously, with the climate the way in which it is, it gives you the opportunity to raise money for other fantastic causes as well, and still remember what Anne gave this city.
When we first put the event on, it was primarily, and still is to this day, about Anne's legacy. Without Anne's fight continually to open them can of worms that people didn't want to face, the court cases simply wouldn't have happened. Yep. There wouldn't have been people up for in the dock, basically, and that was primarily down to Anne
and the inquest, down doors, the
and the inquest. Yeah, ultimately, what happened following that and the cases collapsing was just a disgrace to everyone involved. It was heartfelt, it still upsets me now thinking about it. But beyond that, when you look at the way the Hillsborough Family Support Group have gone their way, and other family members are sort of saying they want to try and put Hillsborough not behind them but move on with their lives, Anne's legacy will always still be up because of this golf day and because of the memorial now. Anne will never be forgotten. And with Anne's fight, a lot of people in this city will always, I don't think benefit's the right word, but will have support because of Anne's fight. This year's chosen charity are Liverpool Sunflowers, which are based in Egbeth. They are a cancer support charity, and they offer up to over 700 to 900 families a month with different type of levels of support, and they have 20,000 cancer interventions when the NHS can't support people. They're an amazing charity, and as an organisation, as the four organisers, we will never give support to a mainstream charity because they don't need our support. We will always try and support the little charities who go about their day-to-day lives, making a massive difference on the people that they support and their families.
So if people want to, you know, you've said, can't get any more in that field. I mean, it's bigger than the Open. You can't get any more in that field. You know, you've got the night event on there, but if people listening to this from wherever they may be in the world wanted to take the opportunity to support, what's the best way for them to get in touch and offer that support?
We've got our Twitter page. We've all got our personal Twitter pages. Anfield Stay on Twitter if people want to DM me or whatever on there. And we've got our Anne Williams Golf Day Facebook page. We've got an Anne Williams Twitter account. And to be honest, we should probably do more social media, but between the four of us, we just haven't got the time.
Yeah.
It's hard. So we go about our day-to-day thing, and just on, we've got 76 players this year. Two people dropped out of the last confirmed field that we've had. And well, everyone who played the previous event always get a personal invite to take their place. That's not keeping it a closed shop, because realistically, we could do this over the full weekend. That'll be brutally honest about it, but as the four organisers, we want to enjoy this day just as much as everyone else. We put a lot of effort into this. This just doesn't happen. It's not like blowing our own trumpets, but some of the levels of prizes that we've got, I mean, they're off the scale.
So who have you got partnerships with this year? Who's worked so hard with you in order to make the day as strong as it can be?
We've got our ambassador is here, Wayne Scholes from Red Touch Media in Ludman. The level of prizes that this man donates to us are off the scale. I can't say what this year's prizes are, but a couple of years ago we sent us to Australia to see Dr. Carl Kennedy from Neighbours. This year's prizes are probably better than that, and I'm not exaggerating. They're off the scale. We've got Till Hatton, European Ryder Cup PGA winning as an official supporter. His management team, Danny, they're just a lovely, lovely fella, and he will give us as much support as he can. We've still got the prize that he donated last year to give out for this year, and as well as this year, he's also given us another amazing prize. We don't do the event for prizes, but I think it's testament to what the event that we're putting on that we have got this level of support. We have 18 hole sponsors. Each hole gets sponsored by a company, an organisation, a supporter. So I'll just read these out quickly if I can. The first hole is sponsored by Anne's family. Second hole sponsored by SOS. Third hole sponsored by PLS Food Foundation. The fourth hole by Keith Colvin, CB Builders. The fifth hole, Peter Firmage Community Assets. Sixth hole, France Dancing and Family. The seventh hole, The Groomer Has It. The eighth hole, CMC Surgery. Hole 9, City of Liverpool. Hole 10, The Purple Hub. hole 11, sinkhole fire and security, hole 12, Hewitton Freeborn, hole 13, the phone surgery, hole 14, kinship carers, hole 15, hat scarf for the badge, hole 16, the farm, hole 17, Spine Cop 1906, and hole 18, Stu Chadwick Plumbing and Heating. For the fourth year, those 18 associations have sponsored the hole on that event. We don't charge the world to sponsor the hole, but they've supported this event since day one. The very, very first event we had 32 players. We're up to 76 now, and as I say, we've got 140 people coming the evening. We can't fit any more people in. The golf course, Heighton and Prescott, that whole event have been amazing to us. They've looked after us from day one. LFC TV come and cover our event. It sounds like I'm blowing it up to be bigger than what it is, but I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for what we do.
I think being proud, I think I'm glad you're both proud of the events, Steve, but also proud of the partnerships and proud of the relationships and proud of the fact that people have invested. And the money is obviously a thing, but it is also, it's the time that, you know, and the respect that it gives, and it's all about the memorial to Anne.
The event, Anne's legacy and the fight gives me the... any mission I need to put this event on with the four other organisers. As I say, I do the talk and I run around do the players, but Andy takes care of the golf side of it. If Andy doesn't mark them scorecards, the event doesn't happen. Sean sits on Twitter and does the Just Giving pages and hounds people for raffle day prizes, auction prizes and whatever else. And then Gaz is the member of the golf course and he liaises with the club whenever we need to speak to them. Without the four of us, the event doesn't happen. It's that simple. With a team, we put the event on and we do it as best as we can and as fairly as we can. As I say, we could do this over the full weekend, but do we take away what we've built up for what the event stands for? It's one day a year and everyone who's associated with it from the first event up to the ninth one now have built it up to what it is. And it's an amazing day for a special, special lady. And she'll never be forgotten for events like this. And rightly so, because it was her fight that got people to where they were.
There you are. That's what you need. That's everything that you need from Steve. If you do want to get involved, you want to check out the Twitter page. There's the Facebook page there as well. You'll find it all if you just put into the search bar Anne Williams Golf Day. Everything that you need will be from there.
There is a Just Giving link as well. So if the lads can tweet that out for us, if you send it over to you, then you can just throw it on the things.
Excellent admin on there. I'll make sure that happens, Steve. Don't worry at all. Yeah. The Anne Williams Golf Day to memorialise one remarkable woman who did so much for the city of Liverpool.
And it is John Givens, and I'm joined in the studio in real life by my good friend Dan Morgan. Dan, thanks so much for coming in to see us.
IRL, London's Dan Morgan, making the trip all the way.
Well, you are now London's Dan Morgan. Tell everyone a little bit more about what you're doing down there before we get into sort of, you know, a little bit more about what we want to talk about.
Yeah, I've taken a job with James's Place charity. Anyone who follows me on social will know that it's an organisation close to my heart after the experience I went through as one of the men through the doors at Liverpool's Catherine Street Centre a couple of years ago now, I think. And yeah, I've sort of gone full circle as someone who used the service, someone then who's championed what James's Place does, and then now, you know, working full time in the role of communications and engagement manager. We've recently just opened our second service in London, and we're going to move into a full-time accommodation shortly, hopefully in the new year. And with that, yeah, this role was something which I think I could bring something to, and felt like, you know, as somebody who has been in a myriad of roles throughout his career, it was something that, yeah, I could really lend to, as well as the passion that I've got for it.
Yeah, interesting CV you've got now, isn't it? But now you're doing this. What are your challenges, do you feel, and what are the challenges generally for organisations like James's Place and so forth, therefore you in this role?
I mean, I have to be honest and say that I'm new to the industry, the charity industry, so I'm learning a lot on the spot and learning as I go. I think challenges-wise for me, you know, I think like anyone starting a new job, you want to be eager to please, and you want to be eager to show that you're competent and capable, and that you can really sort of do the job. So that's the initial sort of challenge at the minute. But along with that, I think for the sort of wider answer to that question, I think constantly it's around awareness. You know, Friday's World Suicide Prevention Day, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, but you know, for someone like James's Place, that's every day. It's not just one day a year. And you know, it's about how the message of suicide on a whole, the concept of even talking about it, mentioning the word, is constantly reviewed, approached, and developed. And you know, it is something from my short time in the role that I can see has come on leaps and bounds through organisations like James's Place. But there's still a long, long way to go and a lot of work to do. And I'm sure days like Suicide Prevention Day will help massively, but it's still only the beginning.
Yeah. In terms of James's Place, then, it's still a relatively young organisation in terms of, you know, other similar organisations, I guess, that are out there. And for what it's been able to achieve, you know, in this city and now in others, you know, deserve sort of applauding, really. And I think it's a remarkable organisation. And I've known lots of people who've been through the doors now and seeing how it's sort of changed them. And, you know, it's the fact that it's now opening, as you say, this new centre in London, you know, they deserve a lot of praise for sort of how far they've come and also how, you know, it's a beautiful building at Liverpool, but they look to get out as much as possible.
Yeah, when you strip it down and look at the service we provide, it's incredible. And I say that as someone relatively new, but, you know, first and foremost, it's free. Secondly, we aim to see anybody referred to us within 48 hours for an initial assessment. And, you know, thirdly, it's, like you say, an environment which, it's said on many testimonies, the minute you walk through the door, you can just feel that it's specifically tailored to help men and people in general who are struggling in crisis. And, you know, that environment, you can't bottle. It's something which is a result of the people, of the work that's gone into it, and of, you know, the constant ways in which they try and evolve and become, which is what we want to be, is you know, not just a lead in terms of an organisation reputationally, but clinically as well. You know, we want to be academically thought of as people who can set the pace in this industry and around this topic in particular, because, you know, the amount of knowledge and expertise and skill that is in such a short team organisationally already is phenomenal. It's wonderful to work with, I've got to say.
Oh, amazing. So World Suicide Prevention Day then, you sort of touched on it before, Dan, but I've noticed as well this idea of using this word suicide more. And I know Jane Boland, who works with you at James's Place, and has been on a lot, you know, it's something that me and her have talked about, in that, you know, she's, you know, very keen, if that is the right word, to sort of start using it more and sort of, you know, accepting that this is what we're talking about. So when we're talking about, you know, mental health, and when we're talking about losing people, you know, it is suicide. We're trying to stop people killing themselves effectively, and we need to sort of be upfront about that almost, really.
Yeah, there's a huge stigma around, if you ask somebody if they're suicidal, it will only further worsen their thoughts and their potential to carry through with something like that. And it's not the case. It's proven not to be the case.
You're not going to put that idea in someone's mind by saying it.
But no, you're not. You're really not. And, you know, that again, is, we talk about conceptions and misconceptions, and I can say from a place of experience, I had so many. Like, I had so many misconceptions around the word suicide. Mm. So I solely associated it with the act, and only through further help and support and going to somewhere like James's Place was I able to see that it constitutes more than just what I thought it was. It's, you know, that you can have suicidal behaviours, suicidal feelings, suicidal, you know, ideals that you might not even be certain that you're aware of. And I certainly wasn't. Mm. But through our intervention and the model of James's Place and the way in which it structures its intervention with men, you're able to sort of go on a journey of looking at what's causing the problem and seeing how you can evaluate it, and then look at potential ways in which that can be modified to ensure that you can, you know, essentially live a better life, which is what we want. What we all want, and what we'd all want for anybody in that situation. And that's, you know, John, I know you've got this experience of, if somebody you love and you know is clearly struggling, you want to help them as much as possible. And sometimes just knowing that a place like James's Place exists is such a, it's such a bonus to have that knowledge in a situation like that, because, you know, you're not being a bad friend, brother, you know, relative, distant relation by suggesting that if somebody you know and you love it, you think is really, really, really in a dark place and really unable to find, you know, any form of solace in that, then, you know, suggesting a place like that is no bad thing, I think.
100% agree, and I think, you know, no one does have all the answers, and if you're not a professional or whatever, or you're not sort of experienced, you know, we can all have the feelings of, oh, what am I, you know, I've spotted some signs, but what am I supposed to do? And I guess what you can do, and what a really good thing is to do, is to educate yourself on what is out there, and that might be James Place if you're in the sort of Liverpool area, or soon to be sort of, you know, London. But, you know, for other areas, you know, there is support out there, and there's professional support out there, and it's being aware of, you know, what's out there in your area, but also sort of online and things like Samaritans and things like that. And you know, organisations that are out there to help people, and there will be something there for all of us, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is the thing we say continuously, is that, you know, we help men in suicidal crisis, and we're often asked why we only help men. And the reason is because we want to be the best at what we do, and also because we're a very, very small organisation. And that's not to say that if, you know, if a female came to James's Place looking for help, or anybody for that matter, however they define themselves, we would automatically be stood at the door turning them away. Of course not. We would help them. We would help anybody who felt like they would benefit from James's Place's service, but we are specifically tailored to help men in suicidal crisis, and that service and that model and that deliverance has ensured that, you know, for the second year running, we're about to launch our evaluation report, and it will show when it's launched that we've continued to inflict positive change on men in suicidal crisis who've used our service, and that will be statistically recorded and available for everyone to look at soon. And also, you know, within that, there's the continuous awareness and reality that we're living in a pandemic, and that cause changes around that. You know, things like housing, for example, is now a massive issue for organisations who are dealing with mental health in people who are struggling, and for a number of different reasons and causes. So, you know, that we've been able also to tailor our service and our model to adapt to the ever-changing climate, like the likes of Samaritans and other organisations have done, is a continued testament to those in the industry. And, you know, we'll continue to keep working hard as hard as we can to ensure that James's Place is available to as many people as possible.
Yeah, which is fantastic. As we said, Friday is World Suicide Prevention Day. If you're struggling yourself, or you know anyone who's struggling, I would encourage you to educate yourself as much as possible, just on the support that is out there. We've obviously talked to Dan about James's Place there today and all the amazing work they do, but there's lots of support available, both in person and online. The NHS website is a really good place to start. They've got their numbers for the Samaritans, Campaign Against Living Misery, and lots of others. There's also a Shout Crisis text line, where if you text SHELT, it's 85258. Someone will come back to you on that. But in the meantime, Dan, thanks so much for coming in, and nice to see you.
You too, John. Thank you.
Hello there. I am joined by Dan Hewitt. Now, those of you who listened to the Anfield Rap for many a year will associate Dan with Yo-Yo Club, and therefore Yo-Yo Premier League contributions on things like the Friday Show on West Bromwich Albion. But Dan's day job is working for ITN News. You may well have seen him on that at some point. Across the last 6 to 12 months, Dan will expand on that, I'm sure. He's been looking into stories around effectively Britain's housing, Britain's social housing, and where it's all gone wrong. There's a documentary, 10:15, on Sunday night on ITV. It is called Surviving Squalor, Britain's Housing Shame. And Dan, I've sort of watched you amass this story across the last maybe 6, maybe 8 months. It started off with one report. It's become a whole string of them. It's something that you've explored very, very thoroughly indeed.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. I appreciate it. And I'll dispute Yo-Yo Club. We had 8 successive seasons in the Premier League. So it's something people always forget about. I appreciate you having me on. And it's a subject we started, it was 6 months ago almost to the day. Just before Christmas, me and my producer were talking about doing a sort of looking at families that were about to have a really tough Christmas. Obviously, last Christmas was pretty tough for everyone, but we were sort of interested in speaking to people and showing people who were living in poor conditions or really, really struggling, whether it's through poverty or universal credit or whatever. And we sort of, started looking for examples of people who are having a pretty tough time, tougher than most. And we eventually found ourselves in Croydon and found ourselves in a block of flats on a road called Regina Road in Croydon in South London. And anyone that saw or seen that report will know just how shocking it was and how horrific it was. And the conditions in that flat were described by Shelter as the worst conditions they'd ever seen, described by the author of the report into Grenfell as the worst condition she'd ever seen. And it was a real sort of shocking moment. Personally, it was just a moment of complete anger from my perspective of that anyone was allowed to live like that. But what set that off from that report, which went out in March, was an incredible response from our viewers, partly obviously out of anger and disgust at what Fran Zoe and her two sons and people in that block were living in. But also this kind of outpouring of people saying, actually, I live in a block like that. I've lived in social housing like that. I'm currently living in a block with mold and damp and leaking and ceilings collapsing and rodent infestations and risks of electrocution. And I've been trying to get my landlord to do something about it, and I'm struggling to be heard. And from there, it just absolutely spiraled. And we had so many messages from our viewers that we set up a dedicated email address. We set up a dedicated team. And other than the odd week, I've basically been working full time on this housing investigation, going around the country, meeting people living in conditions which should be completely belonging to a different era, unimaginable, unthinkable squalor that you'd think that we'd got rid of 100 years ago, but people in Britain today are living in it.
The going around the country part is just something I want to focus on. I'm not shy about making a joke about London here and there and all of that sort of stuff. But the key part about this is that it isn't geographically based at all. This huge inequality in living conditions, it isn't geographically based. It is everywhere, and that's one of the things that you've discovered from the avalanche of emails and then from the places that you've gone out and seen.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd say from our investigation, London is a particular problem. I think partly that's because there's more people live there, and I think that's probably more of also an historic thing of where council house stock is left now. I mean, we can go into it, Right to Buy and Margaret Thatcher if you want in a moment, but it is definitely a kind of UK wide thing. I think England has it probably worse than what we found than Scotland and Wales. Northern Ireland, we are yet to really kind of get into in lots of details, but we are currently looking at that. And that's it. And that's partly to do with you have to sort of go back to the 1980s and look at what happened with council housing. I mean, council housing, it's an amazing statistic. In the early 1980s, a third of Britain lived in a council house. It was a completely mainstream, normal thing to grow up in a council house. You didn't need to be poor, you need to be vulnerable. If you needed a home, your local council almost certainly had one for you. And that was for a third of the country. My parents grew up in council houses, and they wouldn't class themselves as particularly vulnerable. It was a safety net for people that couldn't afford a home, and that's where it went. And then it started to change in the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher gave people the right to buy their council house, which you can argue all day, and that's several podcasts on that one. But the problem with the right to buy scheme was that it didn't replace the housing stock. It didn't replace the homes that were sold. And so today we have a situation where we have between 1 and 1.5 million fewer council or social homes than we did in the 1980s. But the population has increased and as demand for housing has increased. So now it's around 8% of the country living in a council house rather than 33%. And so we have this problem. And then you have the problem of the stock that's left is old. It was built, a lot of it was built in the 1950s and 60s. It's not in particularly great shape. It wasn't built to house families of 4, 5, and 6. It was never built for that. And it was probably wasn't built to last 70, 80 years. And so you have this kind of coming together of lots of different factors that are leading to people across the country living in, and the word is squalor. It is squalor. They are squalid conditions that we've been finding.
With the documentary then, which as I say is Sunday, it's 10:15, it has been an ongoing thing through the entirety of the investigation. I'm not asking you to have answers per se within this, but it must have been, you've used the word eye-opening obviously through this. It must be deeply concerning. There must be something you are looking for from a next steps point of view, a commitment, a shift, a change somewhere. And that must come through the tone of the documentary, which, you know, from the trailer I've seen and of some of the reports I've seen, when we talk about the squalor, when you talk about the squalor, it seems easy for people to sort of to disconnect it from the human. These are, you know, your interviews are with people who were broken by this, broken by the fight against it in a sense, in their own conditions, but also broken by what it is they're living in. So, you know, the putting the people at the center of it, which, you know, as I say, it's definitely come through in your reporting so far, and it sounds like it's going to come through in the documentary as well. Those people do need change.
They do. And I think part of, there's sort of two things going on here. You have the one side of this, which is, anyone that's seen any of the reports we've done, and you'll see this in the documentary on Sunday, is people living in, say, on unimaginable conditions, and not just for days or weeks, but sometimes months, and in some cases years, people really struggling to get things fixed and done. But that's the second part of it, is actually the thing that often is the sort of tipping point for people is not actually the conditions themselves, but the fact they just can't get them fixed. They can't get them, anyone to come even look at them. I mean, I remember being in a flat in Bristol with a mum and her two children, and they'd had this awful, awful damp and mould issue, which was nothing they were doing. It was completely to do with the building, which the Housing Association later admitted. And she would ring up every few weeks and say, can someone come and look at this? I'm trying to do my best. She'd been in there 3 years. She decorated three times. She redecorated every year because the wallpaper would peel off the walls. To the point where she ran out of money and she had to nail the wallpaper to the walls with nails, with a hammer, to keep the wallpaper from falling down. The big thing for me was the fact that in the 3 years she'd been complaining, not a single manager or housing officer from the Housing Association had come around to see the house. She had rang and complained. And every single time she complained, they'd forget. They hadn't linked any of the complaints she'd made. It was like a fresh complaint every time.
Yeah.
And I remember just, and that's happened a lot, where you sort of hear these stories. And I don't know about you, but if I had to ring up two or three times to complain to an energy company or a bank or anything about, and I had to explain myself every single time, it would drive me insane.
Yeah.
And that's what you're dealing with here. And so that's the thing I think that actually tips a lot of people over the edge. It's not the conditions themselves. It's the fact they just feel completely ignored. And the documentary very briefly touches upon this, but the elephant in the room of this entire investigation is Grenfell. Grenfell was the extreme end of people not being listened to. It was, and there's a great documentary this week on Channel 4 on it, of people complaining and reporting issues and even mobilizing themselves and still not getting listened to. And the very worst thing happened. And I have to say, I have gone through this that last 6 months and I have woken up at night. I have woken up in the morning. I have been driving to jobs where I've thought, am I going to report on someone dying? Because that someone we've spoken to. Am I going to report on some of the case studies we've spoken to getting seriously injured because they've been electrocuted? Or because they've become seriously ill, or they've fallen over, or their child has fallen over, because that's the kind of level of squalor we're talking about here. So the point about things changing, I think from our point of view, it's about getting these stories out there and not forgetting that Grenfell happened 4.5 years ago. But what can we really say has changed in that 4.5 years? We haven't found much evidence that people have been listened to more than they were 4.5 years ago. But ultimately, this is a systemic problem. There aren't enough houses in this country. There are not enough affordable homes to rent for people. And the National Housing Federation and others have apologized and said they're going to change and put more money into the system, and that's fantastic. But until the government basically commits to building a lot more homes than they are, this problem is not going away. And it's not a kind of, I'm very happy our journalism has made an impact, but this needs the government to realize this is a much bigger problem than putting a bit more money in. This is going to be a kind of revolution in the way we see homes and people living in this country. And I have to say, from my own point of view, I've seen very little evidence that the government gets that.
You can see it on Sunday night. You can follow Dan on Twitter at Daniel Hewitt ITV. You can see the show on Sunday night, Surviving Squalor, Britain's Housing Shame, ITV, 10:15 p.m. Very much the essence of public service broadcasting. Thank you very much to Dan. Let's get back on with the show. There you have it. Thank you very much indeed to the two Dans and for Steve for giving over the time and telling us what they've been up to, and also the excellent work that they've done, that they've been part of, that they've been working on for some time. You know, there's lots of ways in which you can always be impressed and proud of people sort of making a difference in the world, and they're all three of them, they're attempting to do something along those sorts of lines. Back now in a second, Neil Atkinson with John Gibbons, with Kev Walsh and with Paul Cope, looking ahead to the weekend's game against Leeds United. It is indeed Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson.
Thought Dan Hewitt was good.
He was, wasn't he? He was indeed. Just
going on here, isn't it? Is this the new Matrix movie?
They're basing it around it.
His head fell off before, is it?
Are we in the past or the future?
There's talk that Heaton is in the new Matrix movie. He's one of those.
He's on his haircut.
Yeah, he's one of those. You know, like in the Matrix, that like in order to make the film longer, they have to go and do a really mad cryptic thing. Someone's got to knock around to Andy's and Seaforth. Keanu's got to knock around to Andy's and Seaforth and have a chat to him about something. He's going to give him an important piece of information. For us, the important piece of information is all about the game coming up against Leeds at the weekend. John, it's a reminder really what a season is. You know, we've just come off the back of the Chelsea game. You've got Leeds away. We don't yet know. I think Leeds might be on a teeny little bit of a wane in the grand scheme of things. We don't yet know that. We'll know how difficult it is to go to Elland Road and get something in a few weeks or months' time. What I would say is I think it'll be especially difficult on Sunday. This is their first big game against a proper football team at home since they've been able to have crowds back in at the start of the Premier League season.
Yeah, we went and did a video preview show, and video subscribers will be able to see that. It's out online now, and we went over to Leeds to do it because one of the reasons was we knew sort of how excited they'd be. And, you know, we did it with a young lad who's never known Leeds in the Premier League. You know, when they sort of got relegated, he was very young, and it's 20 years, which is flown by in a way for sort of us. We're all around 40, aren't we? But for, you know, people in the early 20s, like he was, you know, he never sort of known Leeds in that. So, you know, they played some Mickey Mouse outfit a couple of weeks ago at home.
Yeah,
at some busies, but this is, you know, this is, you know, a six-time European champion coming to Liverpool. And this is the kind of game where, you know, not being big head, when you were in the Championship, is like, oh, we want to go be playing teams like Liverpool again at home, and at 4:30 on a Sunday, I'm sure they'll be out for it. I'm sure they'll be sort of enjoying it, and they'll take some beating on Sunday, and that's the way that Liverpool need to view it. You know, it's not to say that we need to fear them or whatever, but we need to turn up, we need to be strong, we need to be sort of first into tackles and all the cliches and that, and we need to put our chances away, because they will give you chances, but they'll create as well. So we need to make sure we take ours when we're on top.
It's a funny thing, Kev, the first three in August, we've lived it all often enough now. I mean, I'm pleased John's reminded us all how old we are in comparison to this young Yorkshire whippersnapper that he's referring to there. I'm of the view that, you know, we've seen enough now to know it's a bit mad, the first three, for everybody at times. It's just a bit weird. It's something that happens, and then it's almost its own weird little mini league. You do the best you can out of it, and you see where you are afterwards. Then, if you're us at the state we are, you're suddenly aware, right, now it's serious stuff, in that you're playing Sunday, then it's AC Milan on Wednesday, then there's a home game the following weekend. They throw you a League Cup one in there, so you can do a bit of changes around that, fair enough, but then you've got another tricky little away game, and then after that you've got Porto, and then you've got Man City. You know, I wonder whether or not we'll see the start of them prepping for that through this, because it is now different. It isn't just these are my lads with 1 week gap over and over again. He's got to start thinking. He's got to start plotting his route through.
Yeah, you've got to do that in this situation. We're lucky that we've got a squad as big as we've got, because obviously you look at I think the obvious one for Sunday is Andy Robertson, isn't it? He's obviously had a difficult start to the season with the injury in pre-season. And I think Scotland have half-flogged him as well during the international. Yeah. Not that I've paid much attention, to be honest. But Tsimikas, when he played south, there was no issues with him, and I wouldn't be worried about throwing him in on Sunday. And I'd probably think maybe even keep him in for AC Milan. If Robertson needs that rest, if not, bring Robertson back, that's fine. But this is around the time where you start, as you say, you can't just go, well, we go game after game after game. When you're playing, that's fine. But you've got to have some sort of plan, So you can't, because you can't say, okay, we'll just play these first four games with these players and hope for the best, because we've seen that that does not work out. So I think this will be the time where we're making a few little changes, and you might, this is the time of the season where you look at some team sheets and you go, oh, why is he playing and not him? And the reason is because in 3 games time, you want him playing. And yeah, you've got to be a little bit strategic about that. And sometimes you just got to swallow what looks like a team that doesn't really work. But with our squad, I'm confident in most teams we pick that you think will be all right with it.
You'll be confident on most sides, Paul. Where I think it's a little different, managers in general don't like to do the thing I'm about to say. I think it's fair to say it's a generalisation. But also, we've had a very specific footballer around this. But where I think it might be a little bit different is he may need to quite continually look at the centre-halves. We've very much known for, you know, effectively since January 2018, it's Virgil plus one. But as wonderful as Virgil is, and I'm sure if Virgil is tuning into this tour live under the pseudonym on the YouTube there, I think he may well be thinking, well, I will play every game, thank you very much. But Liverpool have got to ensure that they're keeping him sharp, they're looking after him. They do not want to take a risk with Virgil. We don't want to see that. I wonder if you might, for the first time, see Virgil miss, even when he himself will feel fully fit, a Premier League or European game in this next little run. It won't be the one against City, but, you know, I don't think it'll be Sunday either, to be honest with you, but it wouldn't surprise me if Virgil maybe gets a little bit more of a break, one more game off in a run like this than we might be used to, or even he might be expecting.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting thing to look out for, because it'll tell us a lot about the manager's mindset and what he really thinks about the other lads.
Yeah.
Because something Kev's just said there, I'm with him completely on Simicast. Like, think he's done himself no harm at all in his performances. And at the same time, he's playing alongside Virgil van Dijk, which for anybody, it makes a massive difference, doesn't it? Like, there was a reason last year he didn't get a sniff. And I don't think it was just because he hasn't settled in properly. It's just a case of, look, I just need me lads. When you've got Virgil van Dijk there, you know, I was going to say one of us could have a game at left back. I couldn't go that far.
The Leeds whippersnapper could.
Yeah. Yeah, he's probably still got the legs, hasn't he? But I do think that there is a possibility here. And to be honest, given the number of centre-halves we've got, there might be more to it than just give Virgil van Dijk a break. And maybe that's the way they sell it to Virgil, is that, look, mate, we've just paid 40 million quid for this lad, and where's he getting his game? Like, if none of yous get injured, and we don't want any of yous to get injured, we've got to give him a game somewhere. And it can't just be in the League Cup. Like, he just play crap League Cup games. So I think there's different ways you could sell it to him. And as bold as Virgil is and as cool as he is on the exterior and very confident and would say, I can play every game, he knows he's just had a serious injury. He knows he's not getting any younger.
He's an intelligent man as well.
Yeah. Like, there are enough players who've gone before him who tell stories of, I wish I'd have looked after myself a bit better because I'd have played longer. And he'll be looking at someone like James Milner and thinking, well, I want to be playing as long as you're playing. So how do I do that? If I miss the odd game, is that actually that big a deal? And I actually hope we do see him rested for a couple of them.
Go on.
I was just going to say, he's got centre-halves there who've not played, you know, any international football. You know, Joe Matip's one who has sort of retired and has been tempted back a couple of times. Joe Gomez doesn't make the squad, you know, this time, which is understandable. So, you know, he's got lads there. Canate's not in the French squad there. So he's got three lads there who've not been playing, you know, these full international games, whereas I'm not sure if Canate's played under 21s or anything, but you know, as Paul says there, if there ever sort of is an opportunity, then it does feel like this is you know, one to do that, you know, in terms of, you know, he could have picked the centre half partnership 10 days ago and worked with them for 2 weeks, you know, and just sort of used this time there. And Van Dijk's been a bit in the wars, hasn't he? You know, there was one tackle that I think got everyone wincing, and he sort of got up from it a bit gingerly. And I know he said after the game that he felt all right quite quickly after, but, you know, it is a bit of a reminder, you know, that he is sort of, you know, obviously just sort of coming back, and, you know, still sort of, we're all a bit sort of worried about it. So it feels like one to me that I wouldn't be surprised if he almost made the decision, you know, last week sometime, that he was going to go with two lads who we've got there, and he's just been sort of working on that ever since.
Come back to you on Paul mentioned Milner, John. Milner has an injury for the last couple. Going back to Ellen Rhodes, I'm sure he'll be very, very eager to play. There is the Fabinho question in amongst there as well. And then the next phase of this is Henderson's been away on England duty. I'd like to see Chamberlain in this sort of game because of the way Leeds play. There can be a lot of space to run into because they're very, very, very aggressive. But if you beat that press, there's room to drive up the pitch. I would have presumed, given the unbelievable drama Kite has lived through, he's probably looking at Milan for his next start. What do you think he does in the middle of the park?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, I think he will just sort of assess it, and that doesn't help in terms of, you know, wanting to plan and things like that. But it is seeing how people sort of come back and when. I think if the Fabinho thing isn't sorted and that a decision isn't made, I don't think they will risk it. I think Liverpool are sort of fairly cautious on this sort of thing. I did like Cope's plan of just do the agreements and just do it. But, you know, I get on board with most Cope plans, to be honest with you. But it's not necessarily served me very well in the past. but you could just talk me into stuff and I'm like, yes, sound up the Reds, let's go. I'm not sure Jürgen will be quite sort of that mindset. So I think unless it's, you know, all sort of agreed and ratified, I think they'll go safety first on it. And so you're looking at sort of who is around. I don't think Henderson's minutes have been too sort of, you know, aggressive. And if we're not playing for Fabinho six,
He's got
to play Henderson there. So if you see Henderson, Thiago's not been away. So I think he definitely starts. And then the other one, I think it is just having a little look at Keita and just seeing sort of, you know, how he's feeling about the whole thing. But like you say, Neil, you know, that everything he's sort of been through and everything, it seems, you know, a bit sort of much to just sort of throw him into sort of start straight away. So I would say it probably, you know, possibly it is between sort of Milner and Chamberlain.
Neither of whom have gone away either.
Yeah, but Chamberlain's been on paternity leave, hasn't he? So so we'll see. Depends. He's probably just happy to get off the house. Do you know what I mean? 2 weeks is long enough, isn't it, Kev?
Yes, it certainly is.
There is on that. I think at some point I'd like to see Chamberlain get that start. The expectation, I think, Kev, in hindsight now, is that he would have started against Burnley, but for the reason that we now know that's in the public domain, we didn't know on the day, obviously, but we do know now. I feel like, you know, one of these that's coming up, I'd like to see Chamberlain get his go in the middle of the park, dovetail with his teammates a little bit, get his season restarted. He does start against Norwich, but I'd like to see Chamberlain get a go myself.
Yeah, I love him. I always say every time he comes up, he's a fantastic player. And if this is the game, as you say, with a bit of space in behind, that's exactly what he needs. Sometimes we bring him on at Anfield, and I feel sorry for him because you're coming up against two banks of five effectively, and it's really difficult to get through that. The issue you might have is Klopp, if we haven't got Fabinho there, might want like sort of two sixes, so maybe a Milner and Henderson. You put Thiago in front of that to sort of spray the ball for the front three. So I'd be happy with either, to be honest. Obviously, Thiago needs minutes, I think, as well. He's like,
he's one of us not enough time either.
He's not playing a lot, and he's a fantastic player against Leeds. I think he's good in the press, actually. He's good at getting the ball back, and obviously he's fantastic at using it. So it's sort of, I'm sort of swaying towards Thiago being.
I'd definitely start Thiago.
Well, see, that I personally, I don't know whether I'm being a bit of a shitbag here, but I'm picking Thiago and two sort of more holding midfielders, just because Leeds do like to try and come at you. And especially if we are going to make a change of Virgil van Dijk, I'm not sure we want to be making fresh legs into centre-half. And no Fabinho in front of them, so you'd have, and only one defensive centre mid. So I think you go for the two more like sitting midfielders and give Thiago a bit of license to roam.
It'll be the front three, presume, John?
Yeah, with Jota, I think for me, you know, we haven't really heard too much, you know, apart from the fact that the family isn't too bad, but I don't think, you know, with obviously the mix of the injury and the fact that we don't even know whether we're getting trouble for him anyway, you'd be surprised if he's involved. Jota's international dwell, I think he scored, didn't he, and got an assist the other night as well. Sadio Mane, I think, has got a goal as well away. So and I think Salah's only played once, hasn't he? The agreement was, and so, you know, those three, you know, makes complete sense to go again, and they're all in the goals this season already as well, which is great, and they will get chances in this game, and I think they'll enjoy it.
Yep. Just to run through the YouTube comments with everyone very, very quickly. Hiya, Stephen. Hiya, Grizz. Nice to see you both. Sausage Lord 102. I refuse to believe that was what you were christened. We should still have enough to be Leeds. Even without our Brazilian lads, he says, perfectly reasonable. Michael Walsh, the Brazil FA thing is absurd, absolutely. And he also makes a wider Saudi Arabian point with reference to FIFA, which is more than fair enough. Raya Mohammed says that three games in a week are due to the international breaks that were cancelled at the height of the pandemic. That is true, John. There's also one to keep your eye on, which is there's a mad international break just dropped in at the end of January that no one's on to yet. Which, you know, I'm all in favour of mad bits of scheduling that you've got to have your eye on from a distance out.
Yeah, no, I didn't have my eye on that, so you are correct.
Yeah, I've got my eye on all sorts of this mad stuff. Fobby Rowler says that he'd be amazed if it's not sorted in the next 24 hours. And then there's some encouragement that people should just listen to Mr. Phil, and there's no argument with that in these parts.
On anything in particular, or just...
No, just life.
just get Mr. Phil involved where you can. I think ultimately, Kev, where I end up just to round it all off for us on this one today is Elland Road's meant to be hard and it's meant to be a difficult place to go. That's what it needs to be, you know what I mean? We need it to be for when our rivals, we need them to drop points somewhere, and Elland Road's a massive part of that. It's the sort of place where that can happen. But ultimately, I feel as though this Leeds side this season, what it might find is last year it was the most intense team every single game. And part of that was there was no crowd in. I actually think that this Leeds side, a bit of its magic weapon last season was, we're going to be unbelievably intense. I don't know quite what they think it looks like if the opponents are suddenly going, well, you've got 38,000 maniacs here. We're going to be unbelievably intense too. And I think Liverpool have got to meet fire with fire. Last season when we went there, we went 1-0 up. The way the game went, we had loads of chances to break and score. We didn't take them. It finished 1-1. I expect to see a Liverpool side do them in.
Yeah, 100%. We've had 2 weeks with a lot of players. You haven't been away on international duties, away on whatever type of systems you're thinking about going forward. And Liverpool, as Pepinda said, our identity is intensity. So we'll go there and we'll start properly. And the thing is, we can sort of rope us out them as well, because Leeds are good, but they're very, very, very front foot. Like against Everton, they were comical in some of the ways they were attacking, because the way they left the defence wide open. So if they do something similar like that to us, and we've got a midfield that can get hold of the ball, and a player like Thiago who can spray it, he could be in serious trouble, I think.
Yep, a little bit of news breaking through this. An injury update being posted by the club that Van Dijk, Naby and Harvey are all fine. John, that's nice to see.
Yeah, good news. Yeah, I think the Virgil one's just, as I say, on that sort of heavy tackle, so I was confirming that one. Keita, you know, fine sort of physically, but they'll see how to judge him. The Harvey Elliott one's good news, isn't it? Because he was obviously carrying a bit of an injury, so to have him available as a midfield option is really good news.
Excellent stuff. Any predictions for the match, Cope?
I think we'll batter them, because I think they're mad and I think their manager's mad. And I think loads of other managers look at him and think, how does he get away with being so mad? Because if I played like him and got battered all the time, I'd be getting sacked. And on that basis, with that very technical analysis, we'll score about 4.
John, I've got a couple of predictions. I think that I'm sort of where Paul is a little bit. I think it'll be a bit tougher than that, because I think that the crowd will play a part, but I think if we get ahead, we'll go from there. On the crowd, I think that the haircuts will be dreadful and somehow the trousers will be worse.
Yeah, we should win the jeans on Sunday, I feel. You know, strong favourite for that. I think we'll win the game as well. I saw someone predict 3-2 in the comments, which I was into as a lively Sunday afternoon. I'm going to say we go 3-1 up and then they get a late one. So it looks closer than it is.
Nervy, all that sort of cut stuff. Kev, what are you expecting other than lots and lots of shouts of Yorkshire and maybe, if they mix it up, West Yorkshire?
Well, I'm expecting trouble outside the ground, because there always is at Elland Road. It's one moody fucking place to go and it's absolutely fantastic. And I'm expecting a 3-1 win for the Reds.
3-1 win for the Reds. Excellent stuff across the boards. I've enjoyed all of that sort of stuff. Liverpool, go on.
So I was going to say, David Lee there said last minute winner, John, for the 3-2. Oh, I mean, I'll enjoy that at the moment, David. But
it'd be lovely in the last minute, but the 10 before sound dreadful.
Yeah, sorry, I ruined your outro there.
No, it's absolutely fine. Don't worry
David
at all.
David Lee got in my head.
I know he's there. He's all over us, making it very, very difficult. And I as I say, yeah, I think the Reds are going to be absolutely fine. Thank you very much for joining us on this tour live today. If you joined us live, but also if you download it as a podcast, all the different ways to enjoy the Anfield app. We'll be doing this again after the AC Milan game. We'll let you know when that is. Look forward to it. Set your alarm and go from there. It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much to Dan Morgan and to Dan Hewitt and to Steve Martin. And thank you very much to Paul Cope, to Kev Walsh and to John Gibbons. Liverpool are preparing to go to Leeds United. It'll be brutal. I hope it rains as heavily as it's raining at the minute in Liverpool City Centre. I got drenched on my way here. I wanted to be a grey masterpiece at Elland Road, and I want Liverpool to give no quarter and get right into the Yorkshire bastards. Sports Social Podcast Network.